welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is off today. You get me, Becky Friedman, in the studio with Luke and Nathan. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Doing great.
Sam's off today because he is officiating a wedding. Yes, atheists can do this. Atheists can actually officiate weddings and marriages, solemnize marriages, even in the state of Washington. One of the best ways that that a lot of atheists will officiate weddings and get the credentials to do so is through Universal Life Church, and we have a great many friends amongst the freethinkers and non-believers and secular humanists that are credentialed through the Universal Life Church. Have you guys ever gotten your ULC credentials and officiated your weddings that way?
No, I never officiated, but I know a few people that are like, you know, Church of Jedi or Church of the Dude.
Church of Bacon? No, wait, what's the, there was another one from, yeah, maybe it was the Dude. There's another old one on
You're talking yeah. Slack? Church
yeah.
of Bob.
Church of Bob, yeah. I know a friend who did Church of Bob, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that it's really cool, and, you know, when we look at things like in Scotland, where humanist weddings are actually outnumbering any other weddings under any other kind of religious, umbrella, we say, look, people want to celebrate their unions in ways that are meaningful to them, not in ways that a church or a governmental hierarchy says that it should be done. So we want to give some awesome congratulations to friend of the show, Roz, who has been on several episodes over the past years, the past near decade that Ask an Atheist has been broadcasting. And so many congratulations to her on her wedding day. Now, it's not always so kind for folks that want to get married, especially if they are wanting to get married to someone that may not be of strictly the opposite gender that they are, especially in places like Poland. Guys, I'm going to take us to Eastern Europe, where an activist in Poland was detained for offending religious sentiment after posters of her artwork popped up around the central Polish city of Płock. The offending image featured the Black Madonna of Częstochowa, a Byzantine icon of the Virgin Mary that resides in an important Polish Catholic shrine, with her halo painted in rainbow colors. Police seized the laptop, cell phone, memory cards, and CCTV footage from Elżbieta Podlesna's residence. Poland's Interior Minister Joachim Brudzinski called the rainbow halo image an act of cultural barbarism on Twitter. Polish penal code criminalizes offending the religious feelings of others by publicly insulting a religious object or place of worship, and offenders face up to 2 years in prison. Please help me understand, guys, why painting the Virgin Mother with her halo no longer gold, but with rainbow colors, suddenly is cultural barbarism. Luke, what's your take on this?
I think it's ridiculous that this is an issue. Obviously, free speech is an issue here. So we can't say what we want if it might offend somebody religiously?
That's a really touchy thing, because at some point, even speaking your own religious values is going to be offensive to someone of a different religion.
Yeah. That scares me about what's happening here now. I mean, in the United States, we're kind of heading that way. And if we decide to cross those lines, that actually really worries me.
Well, if we're taking any cues from Poland, I got to figure out what it means to insult the religious feelings of others by publicly insulting a religious object. So if I point to an object and I say, you're kind of lousy looking, and if someone's offended by that, then I'm suddenly guilty of a crime.
Yeah, that's a really weird gatekeep.
Yeah. Should I go to jail because I have an upside down cross sitting on my mantle?
Oh, do you have an upside down cross sitting on your mantle?
I do. It was a Halloween prop I just never took down.
Is it rainbow colored?
No, it's not. It's actually like a polished brass cross. I think my dad made it some time ago.
You know what? I hate polished brass upside down crosses. They all should be rainbow. I have just insulted your religious object. Are you offended, Luke?
Well, it's not especially important to me. So no, but I'm sure someone somewhere would be offended, and you should probably be punished for that.
2 years in prison, right?
I think that's appropriate.
You know, especially if I were someone that, you know, has a history of my intense activism in favor of civil rights, human rights, rights for LGBTQ equality, you know, like how Elizabeth Podlesna was one of 14 women who actually in 2017 was attacked, like literally physically attacked, because they held up a banner that said stop fascism.
So has anyone else heard people on the far right calling fascism a leftist dogma?
Yeah, I've seen some of that. I have, and you know, you we were talking about this a little bit earlier about how we have this really extreme far right and the right. and the ideals that are there, and a lot of what they are making fun of end up being very like either it's one of two things: either it's something that they espouse themselves, and it's actually kind of a leftist idea, or they're very succinct in saying a value like, oh, look at all these leftists. They want human rights and they want to treat people nicely and they want to have nice stuff. And well, all this sounds great, guys. Like, you know, you don't usually need to sell it. Yeah.
Usually I hear them saying they're going to take all our stuff and, you know, tax us into oblivion and then destroy society.
So in the case of this particular thing, there was an Independence Day march in Warsaw in 2017. And there were these far right protesters that were actually marching with these racist symbols and fascist symbols and slogans on their posters and banners that said things like white Poland or Poland for Polish or Poland for whites only. And we see a simple image like stop fascism as saying you're the real fascists, you women who want to make the Virgin Mother have rainbows around her halo. That is that what you're kind of alluding to here?
The anti-fascists.
It's all very confusing when you say literally, let us just have equal opportunity and rights for marginalized people. Suddenly, that's what fascism is. It's a very disingenuous way to turn your own accusations on their head towards someone else.
Well, and, you know, by pushing equality and making it so that they can't marginalize you, well, that's part of their religious freedom to make fun of and oppress people. So now you're stopping up, and it kind of gives up what they're actually right. all about. So.
Well, in terms of giving up what they're actually all about, you might think, well, why would she choose this particular Byzantine icon to propagate these posters of the Virgin Mary with a rainbow halo? And this is a very important shrine within Polish Catholicism, so much to the point that in July 2018, so last summer, there was an LGBTQ equality march. So not a pride march where we say, yay, we're proud that we can be public. This is just a march saying, please give us equality because we exist and are humans too.
Yeah, just treat us like people, please.
Right. This was a march that actually had their endpoint, their destination, of wanting to be the shrine. And there were a whole bunch of Catholics in Poland that were more than thrilled that the police actually stopped the equality marchers from getting to the shrine, because that would have been a super huge problem, guys. Because remember, what does the Polish blasphemy code actually say? And I'm going to call it a blasphemy code because that's what it is. You know, it's you can't offend the religious feelings of others. So you can't hurt someone's feelings by publicly insulting religious object, so I can't say that your upside down cross should be rainbow colored because that might offend you, or by insulting a place of worship. If I say, oh, you know what, there's so much traffic there, I hate that place, I've suddenly insulted it. And if you, a worshiper of that particular thing in that shrine, are offended, oh, I'm guilty. If I want to show up with a bunch of, slogans that say, hey, gay people are humans too, please give us rights, I have then insulted the sanctity of a shrine. This is bonkers to me. And, you know, we talk about in the U.S. how we think that, we think of places that restrict free speech and persecute religious individuals based on blasphemy laws. We think of things like Pakistan or Malaysia or Brunei. But this happens in, you know, many European countries that have had these things that are really, truly blasphemy laws that are disguised as we need to keep the peace. And if people's feelings are offended, it means that we won't be peaceful.
These are the same people that are afraid of Sharia law.
The same folks.
And they're creating Christian versions of the same thing.
And they're creating systems under which things that are, you know, Muslim Sharia law can actually take some footholds, and then they get really mad and then they say, oh, the EU is enacting Sharia law. Well, actually, they're enacting Christian Sharia laws, right. And then there might be some Muslim groups that are able to piggyback off of that.
Unintended and that's why consequences.
Yeah, and as soon as that happens, oh no, we can't actually have that, right?
In order to have true religious freedom, you cannot legislate against speech that offends others, because anyone that will take a verse from the Quran or one of the Hadiths and then state it, it can be offensive to someone who does not believe as they do. Anyone who takes a verse from the Christian scriptures and says that those who do not, acknowledge the Holy Spirit are fools. Well, that's insulting to me. If I chose to be really insulted by that, I could have my feelings offended and jail you for literally just reading from your book, right?
But you're not Christian, so I don't think your particular offense would be considered important.
My offense would not be considered important. What if there was a Hindu person that was offended by someone reading from the Bible, a Catholic person reading from the Bible, say, those who do not acknowledge the Holy Spirit are fools? Would that Hindu person's offense be honored within the context of Poland? Poland that was so eager to have a protest stopped before it got to a shrine, just wanting to have rainbows to be present and to have gay people be acknowledged as humans. Yeah, I think you're onto something
here. It's not sustainable. So
So we might think that the outrage and the offense only happens in, other places. I mean, now that we know it happens in Poland, you would think that, well, United States is free from that, right? No. Because we have big corporations, not our governments yet. But we have big corporations that also really want to donate to places and fund and support places that will be totally happy to enshrine, if you will, these kinds of attitudes. A vice president of the fast food sandwich chain Chick-fil-A says that they will continue to donate to groups hostile to or opposed to LGBTQ rights because of a higher calling to help children. The company's VP of Corporate and Social Responsibility, Rodney Bullard, who also directs the Chick-fil-A Foundation, argued that helping young people takes priority over any political or culture war that's being waged, presumably a reference to increased calls for civil and human rights for LGBTQ individuals. And in 2017, Chick-fil-A donated more than $1.5 million to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which requires its members to abide by sexual purity rules and refrain from homosexual acts. Other smaller sums were given to a Christian residential home for troubled young men that holds the view that being gay is wrong, and also to the Salvation Army, which has fought against employment anti-discrimination ordinances. Oh, there is so much to unpack here, guys.
Well, have either of you ever eaten at Chick-fil-A?
I have not.
Neither have I. I've never had.
I don't think I have either.
So for me, as soon as I found out about this a few years ago, I decided I would never eat there. For me, that's not a huge sacrifice because I hate fried chicken. I'm not going to.
But it's not your higher calling necessarily to do this. But what really ticks me off about this higher calling thing, we say we have a higher calling to help children, right? So whatever someone's doing, if it happens to be discriminatory against LGBTQ people, that doesn't matter because we're helping children.
Well, and
how?
Yeah, and like I would say, how is that actually helping children? And this is also part of the same group of people that have been involved with the Hobby Lobby and some of the other rules. And they have these, I think the ruling on that was sincerely held religious beliefs. But a corporation can't hold a belief because it's not actually a person, even though maybe legally it is.
But it is.
Right. Corporations are people, not. But it's like, well, how do you actually sincerely hold the belief? And it just really sounds, again, this is something that's very unsustainable. There's so many directions that this can take. It's so open to interpretation and the individual corporation to do whatever, that as soon as we have any, even a smaller corporation do this, but like a Muslim, or I'm looking for the Satan version of this, then maybe we'll actually have some backlash.
From what I gather, the Satanic Temple's working on that right now.
What I'm looking at is not open to interpretation, in my opinion. You want to have a higher calling to help children. Well, LGBTQ children, or those who are teased for or identified as being gay or queer or trans or gender nonconforming, they have among the highest rates of attempted suicide, of succeeded suicide. Those who are children of same-sex couples might be open to lots of different kind of teasing and taunting. When you have these kinds of organizations that uphold these attitudes that being gay is wrong, to me, I cannot, on my conscience, say that to ignore LGBTQ rights is to help children, because you cannot help children by supporting someone and by supporting organizations that alienate and degrade the idea of someone who is not in your, cisgender, one man, one woman family unit.
Right. They're all about helping straight Christian children.
Or
they
helping
probably tell us that.
Right, they should, right? And then saying that this is just a political and culture war that's being waged. Well, you know what? You can lay down your arms. It doesn't have to be a war, Chick-fil-A. If you really want to be socially responsible, you don't have to wage this war. It doesn't have to be. You can literally lay down your arms. You can throw them into your, swords into plowshares, Take cues from your own scriptures, right? And say, you really want to help children? Okay, that's fine. So you think that Fellowship of Christian Athletes, right? That's for, youth serving organizations and things like that. But you have to abide by sexual purity rules and refrain from homosexual acts. How are you saying that that's helping children when you're instructing children into any kind of sexualized act? Children
right.
shouldn't be involved in any sexual acts.
On top of that, let's be shameful about our bodies.
Yeah, to say that that's something that's helping children,
no.
you've lost me right off the bat. You lost Luke because he doesn't like fried chicken, but you lost me on the, and I think you're with me on this well, on the harming, on the helping children act.
Well, and who are they going to help? I mean, if they're really going to just help straight Christian, families. Well, it turns out that at some point you can take everybody that's just straight people that are just Christians, and not all of their kids are going to be straight or Christian, and all of their kids, you're the mothers and fathers of people who are, gay or people who are not Christians might very well be Christians. And so you can't, there's no way this is going to help anybody.
To be fair, these are probably the same people that kick their kids out for being gay.
Well, sure, but then they just disown them, and now they don't count as kids anymore. And then
I don't think that's being fair. I just think that's being honest about what their practices
are. Yeah, that's true.
Are.
That's true, yeah.
And their proposed solution is to donate $6,000 to a home that helps, quote, troubled young men. There's nothing troubled if you are a dude who is gay or identifies as gay or is exploring what that means and exploring your sexuality. You're certainly not being helped as a child if you are a young man, right? Maybe an 18-year-old who is, forced by your family into a residential home in order to learn how to, act straight.
Like a man, in quotes.
Yeah.
The trouble here is forcing people to be shameful of who they are and not act the way they feel they need to. And that really bothers me.
Well, and I think you mentioned the amount. You said it was $6,000?
There was $6,000 to that residential home.
So $6,000, we're talking about Chick-fil-A. That's a large corporation. $6,000 basically isn't even a rounding error. Right. It's such a non-amount of money, right? It's almost nothing. Like, it literally almost doesn't exist to this kind of corporation. And for them to put that $6,000 there, that has nothing to do with their actual, donation. Oh, we want to support this group. They've spent more on lawyers dealing with all the messaging involved in this than they have on that $6,000. This is really about a message that these are the kind of people that we would like to support, and we're not even really going to support them because it's $6,000 is nothing. And so it's really just creating this message of hate.
Yeah.
And again, they're giving up their position by giving $6,000.
And we've had folks that say it's not actually Chick-fil-A. They're all franchised as individual places. Individual, establishments can be wonderful to the LGBTQ community. But at the same time, okay, so we know that Chick-fil-A ceased its political and nonprofit donations in 2012. So why are we having this revealed that they donated all of this money?
it's for this, right? They created a foundation with their name.
Yeah, there's an actual foundation that all their donations go to, and then the foundation distributes them to the far-right organizations.
And if the far-right organizations are going to complain about Planned Parenthood's foundation of nonprofit that's totally separate monetarily-wise, even more separate than these two groups, you know, if they're going to complain just because they have the same names in the names of their organization, then they know how to play the game. They're not, you know, they're playing dumb, but they're not.
Well, in terms of whether they're more separate or not, the vice president for corporate and social responsibility leads the foundation.
So really, they're like not separate at all. They just like to pretend it.
Barely separate. We're going to pretend legally that we're separate entities with some pieces of paper.
I think, well, you're listening to Ask an Atheist. I think when we come back after the break, we'll have a slightly more happy reveal about what's going on in our country that actually embraces and normalizes and recognizes LGBTQ individuals. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. You can find us at atheist.radio.
The salesman will tell you that squidding cures squiditis, but it doesn't. It only makes you uglier.
Trust me, I'm Johnny Johnson, and I was diagnosed with squiditis when I was 17. I tried squid ink, but it didn't do anything except for make me even uglier.
So tell me, where do you want squid ink?
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. Cephalopod is not real.
Ah, no.
Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Like I said, Sam is on break right now, but you got me and Luke and Nathan in the studio, and I'm really glad to have you guys both here because while I work with children 180 days out of the year in my job as a public school teacher, you guys work with children basically for 18 years straight, right?
Oh, yeah.
And probably even beyond that because you guys are both parents.
Yes.
In your own families. You don't parent the same children.
No.
Your own and your shared responsibility children. I want to know, did your kids or you ever watch PBS Kids Arthur?
I think it was a little bit before me. I believe my brothers both watched it a lot, but they're a few years younger than me. My kids, we don't really do broadcast TV so much at home.
Okay, all right. Well, you can find it on, you know, streaming, internet, and PBS Kids Online and things like that. How about you, Nathan? What about in your family?
Yeah, so my kids have, I think, seen a few episodes. It's just not really for them. I think, you know, it's an older style of programming. It's a little bit slow, and so we're not on the TV a lot, so I don't think they've seen a ton, but I'm pretty sure they've seen some of the cartoon. I watched a little bit of it, but I'm also, again, I'm 34, so I'm right at that, almost being too old, but my younger brother, I think, watched some of it, so I'm pretty familiar with it.
Well, I'm familiar with it from myself being like a little fourth grader reading the children's books before it got adapted into a series on PBS. But the reason that I'm talking about it today is because a recurring character from the PBS Kids show Arthur was revealed to be gay in the program's 22nd season premiere this week. Arthur the Aardvark and his anthropomorphized friends discovered that their teacher, Mr. Ratburn, is engaged and mistakenly assume that he is to wed a female character that they believe to be unsuited for him. The children are surprised to learn that on Mr. Ratburn's wedding day that the woman was actually his wedding planner and sister, and that their teacher was actually marrying a male character who runs a chocolate shop. Prominent Christians, of course, like creationist Ken Ham, tweeted that PBS and Netflix were out to capture your kids and pervert their minds, while Franklin Graham called on his followers to rise up and tell PBS that they do not want to see this kind of programming slipped in to try to influence the hearts and minds of our children and grandchildren.
I can almost feel the Christian gasp of horror.
But yet, let's make sure that we give lots of heterosexual messaging to our kids on a regular basis, because that needs to be like super maximized. That one's
you're losing me, Nathan.
Let's sexualize children by
Let's not do that. Let's stop doing that.
I know, please. It's so silly. The argument that, you know,
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really like, I watched the episode because I was super thrilled. So Jane Lynch was guest voicing on this particular episode and was playing the character of the sister and very domineering wedding planner. And the kids were like, Mr. Ratburn's so nice. And this woman is bullying him and saying, because it said, we need to toughen you up. And the kids were really afraid that that was going to be the person that he was going to be marrying. Turns out, oh no, this is just a sister. And the sister kind of then was very happy to celebrate the wedding and officiate. So she was the wedding planner. She was the officiant. It was cool because it shows that people can have weddings in a non-religious fashion, that family members can be the ones to officiate a wedding, and that it just happens to be that there's the person that's walking down the aisle with their fourth grade teacher happens to be a dude, and the kids are kind of shocked, but not because it's a dude. The kids are shocked because it wasn't who they thought he was marrying. And they were like, oh, phew, what a relief. He's marrying a nice person.
Well, I think, you know, if this was aired 10, 15 years ago, there might be more of a, oh, he's marrying somebody. He's marrying a man. And that might be something. But the messaging that they gave is, it doesn't even go that direction. So it does more to normalize it right. than just, we're going to make this a token gay character. Or something like that. I mean,
the lesson at the end is that there's something that teachers definitely should never, ever do. And that's dance. Because kids are, of course, embarrassed by adults dancing in their really stupid, awkward ways. That's the thing that's awkward for
I'm
these little fourth graders.
My own dancing. It's pretty bad.
Well, don't dance in front of a bunch of fourth graders.
I definitely won't.
It's really easy to embarrass fourth graders. It's great.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
So we have, of course, if you look in any number of Christian publications, you have this that gasp of shock. If you look in a tremendous number of LGBTQ publications and blogs, you have a celebration, right? This cheer. And it's amazing to think it's literally just a non-controversial representation of an identity that causes us to cry, right? That causes us to have joy, that something that is similar to your life is represented on television and represented as something that's a non-issue. And at the same time, you have these folks that are having these gasps of impropriety wanting to take away that joy of having someone represented. And Nathan, you did say that, you know, maybe if this was 10, 15 years ago, it would have been revolutionary, but the kids would have been reacting in a different way. We did actually have reference to non-heterosexual, you know, one mother, one father parent families within the Arthur series about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Where one of the characters goes and they visit someone and they find out that someone has two moms and there's a few lesbian couples raising their kids, and Buster just remarks, oh wow, that's a lot of moms, right? Because at some point kids are like, oh, my mom's really annoying, and then they kind of lament like, oh my god, if I had more than that many moms, how annoying it would be, right? From the kid's lens, from that view of, wow, that's just different from my family, but not something that's wrong. Certainly not something that, as Ken Ham says, has perverted your mind and captured your kid, right?
I can only hope that Ken Ham, that I can do something that Ken Ham would comment on that was perverting kids and or whatever, you know, reactionary thing. I would love to have that. That's a benchmark that you know you're doing the right
that
thing.
That is a mark. I mean, that's like
yeah.
Check.
A trophy.
A big
yeah.
check.
Yeah.
So you guys don't do a lot of broadcast programming in your homes, but from knowing you guys, your kids have fallen down the YouTube rabbit hole occasionally.
Oh.
Yes.
In terms of things that really capture your kids that people could be, I don't know, freaking out about, that's not something like two gay characters or two dudes getting married in a cartoon. What are the kinds of things that would be problems, that would be difficult to have your children exposed to and then wrestling with?
Well, there's a lot of really, I'm going to use some terms that might sound like very reactionary, very like subversive programming that's kind of radical or whatever. But a lot of that is, there's a lot of fanfic kind of material. So we're talking, you know, Thomas or Minecraft or Pokemon or
yeah.
whatever, something. And then there's people that produce content that's relatively wholesome because a lot of it's just kids playing with toys or whatever. You know, we'll even get beyond the fact that why are your kids watching other kids play with toys on YouTube when they should just go play with the toys themselves. But it's a little too meta for me. But there are problems with some, there are known, you know, pieces of content that are pushed into these that are marketed as children's programming that slips under the radar, and it's pretty violent.
Oh yeah,
it's pretty scary. It's really adult content.
Yep.
In some form or another, and you know the algorithms on YouTube aren't that great. The robots that control everything can't find it.
So I've actually stumbled across anti-Muslim Russian propaganda.
In the form of
children's entertainment.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was not good. So that was stopped. Violence is often an issue, especially in video game videos, like the Mortal Kombat 2 is coming out, and some of the kids were watching that and was like, okay, we need to stop that. That's not appropriate at all.
So and this is on
gratuitous
YouTube.
Violence is really my issue.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, there's a lot of extra characters that get thrown in. There'll be Minecraft, but then some fanfic will bring in some other character that's fictionalized, and it's just really awful.
I keep track of what my youngest watches pretty closely. The older kid, he's 13 now, so we regulate that a little bit less, but make sure he's pointing in the right direction, realizing some things are inappropriate or maybe you shouldn't treat people like that. Again, my biggest problem is going to be violence and, you know, propaganda.
So for folks that are having this this cry of, oh my goodness, PBS Kids is trying to propagandize to our children in the ways of Satan, you know, what kind of do you think that you could have a common ground with these kinds with these parents that want their children exposed to something that per their own parenting values is worthwhile and not harmful or damaging to your children? Where do you see you could make that bridge?
The problem is that, unfortunately, a lot of the people that are really going to have a problem with Arthur, with a character on Arthur marrying, you know, having a secular gay wedding, the people that are going to have a problem with that, fundamentally, that there is no bridge. I mean, superficially, you know, their parents, they're going to have some values that match up with mine. I mean, that's great. These people probably aren't bad people, but the fundamentals of their beliefs are severely broken, and it's a real problem. You know, religion is very poisonous to people.
It's definitely a difficult issue to get past. Usually I can relate as far as the importance of family and raising my children to them. But the finer points of what is correct based on my religion, really, at work especially, I don't bring those those particular concepts up. It just doesn't work.
So
it's hard.
We've got an inquiry from one of our listeners. This is Dylan from Kentucky, and he wrote to us through emailing questions@atheist.radio. If you've got questions, you can email us questions@atheist.radio. And he says, I'm a non-believer, or better yet, just consider myself in the vein of the late Hitchens, an anti-theist, in that I detest the idea of religion in any and all forms. I've been divorced from my first wife, who is an evangelical Christian, for a couple of years now, and we have two children together whom I love with all my heart. Just the other day, my daughter, who is 5, and my son, who is 4, came home to tell me that they dare not lie because lying will send them to the devil. I don't even know how to sum up just how disgusted I was and am. The thought of my two children having to grow up with fear of fictional beings. Now that these seeds have unfortunately been planted, when and how would be the correct time and way to explain to them that there's nothing to be afraid of? When and how can I explain to them that there's no evidence to suggest that they need to be afraid of an imaginary fireman underground who knows when you lie? Please help.
Doesn't Christian dogma generally state that you don't go to hell if you believe? So lying in itself shouldn't cause them to go to hell in the first place.
Ooh, only if you're a liar about your true belief.
There's that. But, I mean, the
it's
idea...
It's still a bad framework.
Right, it is a terrible framework. But they shouldn't lie, yes, but they shouldn't be afraid of eternal damnation just for lying.
Well, and as far as the kind of advice that I would give Dylan is a couple of things. One is, you know, he's talking about these kids are being taught not to lie, and they're being taught not to lie for, like, the worst reasons.
Right.
So certainly to combat that, you tell them not to lie for the best reason, which is you shouldn't lie because that's hurtful to other people,
right?
And you would care, and how would you feel if other people were lying to you? And
so you mean growing some empathy in young children?
Yeah, using
that's a good one.
Using a secular framework that's more about the people involved and having healthy relationships that we know are sustainable between people. And
this is something you can do now immediately when they're young. You're gonna have to try to create some sort of way of dealing with it in the future. The biggest thing I can say here is do not force them to believe like you do, because that's just going to push them away, especially as they get older.
Yeah. And to piggyback on that one too, make sure you're not saying, the other parent is the bad one.
Never attack the other parent. That's never okay.
Yeah. That's the quickest way to get that.
Yeah.
That's going to come back and bite you.
So you guys both have experience in co-parenting with a current partner and then also the partners that you created your children with.
Right.
And although you don't really have some different kinds of belief clashes, there are going to be different parenting things that come up. Are there things that you can, besides don't attack the other parent in front of your kid, right? Don't try and turn your kid
around
the parent.
That's a big one, yeah.
What are some of the other things that you think might apply to someone who is parenting with someone who is not of the same religion, whether they're coupled or divorced or separated?
So having to deal with another house has never been a thing I've had to do. I'm sure Nathan might have more experience here.
I mean, as far as just general stuff, besides more co-parenting issues, really the big one is you have your time with your kids and you can obviously parent the way that you want to parent them. My goal as a parent is to raise my children into independent adults. And so it doesn't really matter what the other household is doing to a large degree, because I still can get that influence. And along the way, there's going to be things are going to be hit or miss. But, at the end of the day, this is your opportunity to be a parent. You can still be a parent and, do it the right way. Teach your kids how to lie, how not to lie for the good reasons. Tell them about skepticism. Tell them how to think for themselves, because being independent is the best vaccination that you're going to get against religious indoctrination.
So many times and across many cultures, we have little tools, little myths that help children behave in certain ways that we would like them to behave. You have, don't go out to the river at night because La Llorona is going to get you, right? In a lot of Mesoamerican cultures. And that's really, okay, scare the kids a teeny bit that maybe a ghosty lady called La Llorona is going to snatch them. But really, it's to prevent children from doing dangerous things. Don't go out past the buoys in the lake because the lake snapping turtle monster will get you. That's trying to get children to do safe things.
Right.
So do you think that there's any value in those kinds of myths, whether they come from a Christian evangelical perspective or a cultural perspective of little stories, to help children do what is good or safe?
Personally, I've never felt that lying or making, I guess it's not really lying so much as making up stories to scare them to be an effective way of parenting. I try really hard to make sure I back up everything I say with some sort of evidence or reason. I'm not perfect at that, but I try to make sure my kids understand why I want them to do something.
So you are not a be good and Santa will give you good stuff, or be bad and Krampus will come and snatch you away?
No.
Okay. You are not an Elf on the Shelf family either?
No.
Okay.
Oh, Elf on the Shelf is the worst.
No, I'm not that at all. I don't even know what that whole thing is. I've ignored it so much.
Yeah, marketing.
It's some new Christian. Yeah, it's a good way to go buy some products. So, yeah.
What about you, Nathan? Do you think that there's any value in stories and myths to help children behave in a safe and good way?
I mean, as a mnemonic, it's a helpful, the reason why it persists, the reason why we have Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and other myths and other things, is because these ideas have mechanisms in them that are in some ways, I wouldn't say sustainable, but they're able to protect themselves because of their usefulness. There is enough underlying utility in some of these as a mnemonic of whatever, that it works. Now, whether those are the only way to do it or even the most effective way, probably not. But, again, it's how you do it. Our kids, we have kids that believe in Santa and we have kids that don't. And that's we can do it in a healthy way. You know, the older kids now get to be involved, and they get, once you've broken the fourth wall, they get to see the enjoyment of it from the other side. And that also gives them the framework of being able to deal with all myths, including religion. It's like, hey, there is this stuff that's made up, and there is another side to it. And it's part of just another tool of skepticism.
So there are many, many children's books, actually, that capitalize on myths and on monsters. And you come to reveal that the monster is actually misunderstood and actually fun and wants to play and has friends, and that, you know, monsters aren't real, or that, you know, something under your bed was just a shadow. And 4 and 5 years old is a pretty ripe time for children to be thinking about those kinds of scary things and to be legitimately terrified, but then also sort of brought out of that mystery and that terror. Do you think that for Dylan, it might be good to have some of those books to read, you know, a library book every week where we look at some other different kind of myth or monster, in maybe the hopes that the children might see any kind of devil or Christian devil as equivalent to one of these monsters that isn't really, you know, real?
That is a fantastic idea, actually. I think for me, when I started falling away from Christianity was when they started telling me that all the dinosaurs were in zoos. And I'd been studying dinosaurs pretty in depth at that point. And I'm like, no, that's not.
Well,
no.
They are. They're in the bird exhibit with the cage on the top.
Right,
that's
right.
Where all the dinosaurs are. That's true.
Tyrannosaurus Rex and
yeah.
the dinosaurs we think of as dinosaurs, not our friendly bird people.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, if you've got a question to ask any of the hosts on Ask an Atheist, go ahead and tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA. Go find us on Facebook at about the same place. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio. After the break, I think we'll have a few other questions from some of our listeners. You're listening to Ask an Atheist.
Wait, we're live?
This is a warning made by the team Hot People.
Squid Ink. It is a lie. For example, the last day.
Hey, kid, wanna buy some squid ink?
Sure.
They never saw that kid again.
Notice, do not listen to squid ink salesmen.
Ever.
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. Cephalopod is not real.
I know.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. So, we've got a news story that I think is really interesting, and I'm not exactly sure how I feel about it, guys. A proposal in the New York City Council to ban the sale of new fur garments is being challenged by Black Christian pastors and ultra-Orthodox Jewish leaders who worry that the ordinance contravenes religious and cultural traditions of marginalized groups. Pastors argued that wearing furs is a sign of status and achievement that African Americans have made it against all odds, and said that a ban would be culturally insensitive. At the same time, rabbis described that many Hasidic men wear fur hats called shtreimels on the Sabbath, a hat related to those once worn by Polish and Russian nobility and royalty. Even though the law would allow resale of existing fur garments and would not ban the actual wearing of fur, detractors voiced concern that individuals selling or wearing items could be at increased risk of hate crimes. What's your first reaction to this, Nathan?
I mean, it's interesting because it's on the cusp there between, is this really religiously protected garb of some kind, or is this just a weird cultural thing? I mean, you have possibly unsustainable practices of fur trapping, or not, or you know,
or
I don't,
raising
I,
farmed
or
kind of
farming.
Meat,
yeah. Yeah, there's all sorts of, you know, there's the animal impact. And then at the same time, it's, you know, I'm not necessarily like an animal rights person, but if it's done in a sustainable, good way, I mean, that's kind of, I mean, American fur traders is kind of a big reason why we're here. And, you know, it's a longstanding.
So you're kind of hearkening to history and tradition in this.
Yeah. So, and, you know, so I could kind of see it going both ways. And, you know, again, as long as the practices of getting the fur isn't just horrible, and obviously we want to make sure that we're not abusing animals.
No, you don't want to do that.
That's pretty awful. But other than that, I mean, it's really just an arbitrary choice. You have this fur coat that's nice, I guess, and if you determine that it's nice, it seems a little arbitrary, but How many other religious things that are protected religious things, aren't those also ultimately arbitrary?
It is. So I am an owner of a hideous black leather jacket that I used to wear throughout college. I tried wearing it once about 5 years ago, and I was horribly, horribly disappointed in myself.
And was it because it was an animal product or because of fashion?
Because it was a fashion thing more than anything else. While I understand the animal rights side of this, I don't mind that I own it. I'm just never going to wear it again, probably.
Okay.
But in this case, are we actually trying to restrict religious rights? Because that I find unacceptable.
So in terms of restricting religious rights, it wouldn't restrict anyone from wearing fur that they purchased in a different county, in a neighboring place, right? It would just restrict the sale of new fur garments in New York City, which is kind of the fur capital of the United States, if not the world. There's a big tradition. There's actually a district in New York City called the Fur District, and that's where coats and hats and other kinds of garments and are made. And you can get very fine handmade, craftsman kinds of things. What I'm looking at in terms of restricting religious rights, there wouldn't be any right to wear these things that would be restricted. But I am looking at, we have marginalized groups that have used these kinds of things as an expression of their culture and religion. And for me, personally, the difference between a cultural tradition of African Americans wearing their finest furs to church in the middle of winter versus something that is religiously dictated, like wearing a hijab in certain Muslim sects.
Right.
To me, I don't really buy that distinction as something that's compelling. For instance, in my school, we used to have a no headwear rule, right? Where unless it was religious. So a Sikh young man could wear his turban. You could have a Jewish person wear their yarmulke, and you could have Muslim girls wear their headscarves or hijabs or gamras as they would. But no other headgear was acceptable. Unless it was for medical things. Okay, so all of our kids with alopecia or someone that had a medical need to wear a head covering could. To me, the difference between that and an African girl who wants to wear a traditional African hair wrap, I don't abide by that kind of thing. Just because it's medical or religious privileges it over something that's cultural. We've spent so many years as a culture policing the black bodies of young women that I find that if we're going to allow religious headgear, we should allow cultural headgear as well.
And I'm almost of the opinion that these cultural things in some ways are more important than religious icons or religious wear. Like I would be much more in favor. I wouldn't do it, but I would be in favor of let's make sure if it's culturally important, that's protected. And then, but not necessarily religious, but there's a lot of crossover, obviously, especially when you're talking about Judaism or Islam or other things too. Right. But the cultural stuff is hugely important and it's arbitrary. It's just what kids wear. Like we need to stop being puritanical weirdos. it's just some clothes, guys.
So back when I was a kid, I'd go to church in my finest t-shirt and jeans. And so culturally this, I don't understand what they're trying to do. So having some understanding there would help me make a decision on this one.
Well, in a lot of traditions, for instance, for the Hasidic rabbis and the men that wear these particular hats only on their Sabbath, there's a commandment that remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy or sanctify it. And there have been interpretations of it, of course, culturally mediated, surprise, surprise, that say, what are the ways in which we can sanctify this holy day? Well, we do it by wearing new clothes. So if we ever, or wearing special clothes, so if we ever get something new, we reserve wearing it for the first time until a Sabbath rolls around, right? So if you get 7 new outfits, you only get to wear them once you've worn it. You know, it takes 7 weeks until you can wear everything because you got to wait till your Sabbath comes around. And, we see that, I guess, in Christian traditions where you wear your new Easter dress or your new Easter suit, things like that.
Or even just nicer stuff during church, even if it's not new, it's still, you have your Sunday clothes, you have your church clothes. And if you feel like you're going to go to church, there's a lot of, the control mechanisms in there are interesting because you feel like I'm in my good outfit. Now I can conform. And this is like a professional setting. And there's all sorts of cultural cues in there.
And you're speaking from personal experience, right?
Growing up. So I'm a former Lutheran, ELCA, and for me, and I was you know religious in the 90s here in the Northwest.
Oh, me too.
And this is a pretty progressive church, so nobody's really going to be super insulted if you're not wearing your finest things. You're not really going to stand out. But this is also, you know, Pierce County in the 90s, so I'm wearing holy jeans that actually have holes in them, not right. The other kind of holy.
I did the same thing, but I was grunge. Missouri Synod Lutheran.
Yeah,
splitters. And so they yelled at me.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's why it's great to be ELCA, because they didn't really yell at you that much. But you know, it's still weird because it's like now you're at a weird quandary. You have these brand new, or maybe the fashion is to wear grungy things as a status symbol. But then now do you wear that to church? But now that it objectively is like literally right. Torn, so it's. There's a little
ironic fashion.
Yeah, ironically wearing your grunge outfit. And then, of course, my mom would yell at me to no holy jeans to church.
Only the holy.
Only the other holy. Yeah, yeah.
So in terms of whether something is culturally dictated or religiously dictated, one of the reasons why it doesn't matter to me is because we know both of those things are fungible. We know that in the 90s, it was high fashion to be wearing your lumberjack, you know, flannel with your ripped up jeans. That was high fashion. So do you reserve high fashion for church? We know that in, you know, 200 and 300 years ago, it was high fashion and a sign of status and nobility in Poland and Russia to wear these big cylindrical fur hats. That is something that has been carried over and adopted into cultures. But we know that that religious things are also culturally mediated and change as well.
And those religious things are important because they're cultural, not because they're religious, ultimately.
What I want to know is there a point here when we do and we have seen an increase and an uptick in hate crimes, when we have seen people that have been othered by a dominant group be the targets of violence or discrimination? Do we have a point? Do we have a point in saying, you know, that that African-American individuals in the United States have had a huge struggle over our 500-year history of being here. And to be able to wear your finest furs on your Sundays in the winter is both status within your community and to everyone else to say that you can no longer dump on us as our culture has. Is this a real thing to be considered when we do see that people are being targeted and attacked? Because I'm not sure. I can't decide at this point.
I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, sure, these people are largely arguing this stuff under religious pretenses. But again, this is culture, and this is important. These are agreed. People, and everything's ultimately arbitrary anyway, guys. You know, it doesn't. I mean, the reason why you're wearing a shirt that's like kind of flannelly looking that has stripes, and the reason why, you know, just. We're wearing what we're wearing because of some random decisions. You know, 100 years ago, boys and girls' colors were opposite and children largely wore dresses. It's, maybe another 20 years before that to get to do that. But still, it's like...
Yeah, all infants wore dresses.
Dresses, yeah.
It's just easier to deal with it.
Yeah, and everything's just sort of arbitrary. So it doesn't really matter. It's not like there's some intrinsic, like, if you wear a yarmulke or if you wear a hijab or if you wear flannel or whatever, there's nothing... It's all the same. It's just clothing on, you know, funny shaped meat bags.
So are they only trying to ban furs for the animal rights reasons?
Yes, it would be for animal rights. And the councilman that has come up with it has brought up other laws and the other bills, other ordinances that do with animal welfare.
Okay. Yeah, that's a difficult one. I'm going to say culturally it's important to them, so they should probably still be able to buy it in New York. But if it comes down to it, how far away do they have to travel to really get
one county over, and with Amazon Prime, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
So there's one more question that I did last week with our host that I wanted to offer you guys. And this comes to us from Megan from Texas, who says, what work of fiction best represents what you do or who you are?
Okay, well, I've been thinking about this one for a little while because it's been up on the page for a little bit. So when I was a younger man, you know, high school, junior, or moving into college and so on, I really identified with Catcher in the Rye a lot. So much so.
Okay. You might have some pushback against that.
I so much so that I named my first son Holden.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
Now,
does it best represent you and
no.
who you are?
As I've aged, I've really reassessed my viewpoint on that book. At this point, so when I was in college, I got a minor in Russian and Slavic literature and culture. So one of the more obscure books that I read there is Too Loud a Solitude by Bohumil Hrabal. I'm going to be, I'm totally mispronouncing that. He's a Czechoslovakian, or what was a Czechoslovakian. It's the Czech Republic now, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He was from there. He wrote that book. It was primarily about a man who hoarded books that were supposed to be burned or crushed. And what he did was he rounded up all these pieces of literature that were supposed to be destroyed. He destroyed some of them, but he kept all of them in his house and hid them from the state.
So why does that resonate with you?
Sort of gathering up knowledge and hoarding it. I definitely collect too much stuff. but in the long, I mean,
so what you're saying is you've got a veritable library of Alexandria in your house.
Some,
there in Kitsap County.
Among books, I have stuff in my garage. It's not a cry for help. Is if you read this book, you would understand that a little more. it's sort of a point that I don't want to continue living in that way, but I understand why the man tried to save as much knowledge as possible in the face of just horrendous state issues.
I love it. What about you, Nathan?
So I've always been a fan, and you know how much it represents me. You know, obviously the books that you're going to be a fan of are going to have some representation, but for me it's always been the dystopian stuff just speaks to me. You know, Harrison Bergeron's just a wonderful short piece that can be interpreted in all sorts of ways, and it's always interesting, you know, to live in that world. But recently I rewatched Logan's Run. The old one, the one with Basil, you know.
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, the character Logan's Run is, you know, especially viewing it now, there's so much there that I can kind of get behind, because, you know, my job as an IT person at a large corporation, I'm kind of working for the man. But yet at the same time, there is a little bit more in depth. There's more out there. And now I'm much more willing to be, it's not like radical or something, but just to be out there and to be, you know, I'm willing to expose some of the truth, even if that means, you know, a little bit of pushback from me, you know, but I'm willing to live my life kind of more publicly. Everything I do on Facebook now is much more public, and just exposing the truth is important.
Well, I love it. You can see that atheists, we have lots of characters and works of fiction that we identify with. You've been listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You can find us at atheist.radio. Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you.
And thank you, Nathan.
Thank you, as always.
Thank you to our listeners, where you can write in at questions@atheist.radio. We'll see you guys next week.